Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Before we start, I want to confirm that all counsel are here for the first case. Is that correct? All right. Very good, then. We will begin with case number one, United States against Luis Garcia and others, 1131-79, etc. And I will allow counsel to come up in the order that they wish.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, counsel for the United States. My name is Adam Altman, and I represent one of the appellants in this matter, Augustin Zambrano. Your Honors, the issue before this Court today is how carefully are we going to safeguard a defendant's Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights to due process notice and jury trial. Specifically, are we willing to indict a man for one crime, convict him of a different crime, and then sentence him based on a crime for which he's neither been indicted nor tried? The United States Supreme Court answers this question in the negative, and so too should this Court today.
Why is that the question? Is it just because of the timing? I mean, it seems to me he was, in fact, indicted on RICO and other charges, and that was what he was tried for. So how exactly do you find such a marked difference?
Well, Your Honor, the government violated Mr. Zambrano's Fifth Amendment rights at trial when it found facts that differed impermissibly from the facts that it alleged in the indictment. And the district court's fact-finding at sentencing violated Mr. Zambrano's Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights.
Now, are you preserving – I mean, it's fine with me for you to preserve this point for the Supreme Court's review, but would you agree with me that as of now, the Supreme Court has never found what I'll call the Booker principle, if you will, to apply to the sentencing phase other than for establishing statutory minima and maxima?
Well, I'm not sure, Your Honor, what you mean by by Booker applying to the sentencing phase. I think that the Apprendi rule and Apprendi versus New Jersey and Alene versus the United States both speak to the district court's fact-finding at sentencing.
Right, but up until now, although you're welcome to correct me if I'm wrong, the Supreme Court has said that in Alene, the statutory minimum and the statutory maximum need to be found by a jury and the reasonable doubt standard applies. But as long as the district court is making fact findings to pinpoint a sentence within the statutory minimum and maximum, then it's acceptable for those findings to be made by a preponderance of the evidence and made by the court, not by the jury.
That's correct, Your Honor. And we don't question, we're not arguing that the proof by the standard is it should be reasonable doubt at sentencing. We understand this court's holdings that proof by preponderance of the evidence is sufficient at sentencing. What we're contending here is that the district court's fact findings violated both Apprendi and Alene.
Which findings?
Well, in count one of the indictment, under count one of the indictment, the jury found Mr. Zambrano and his co-defendants guilty of general racketeering. The jury made no special findings as to any predicate RICO crimes. Under section 1963 of the RICO statutes, a violation of section 1962 carries a maximum sentence of 20 years imprisonment. But that sentence can be aggravated to a life sentence if any of the predicate RICO crimes are crimes that would carry a life sentence, for example, murder or conspiracy to commit murder.
But Mr. Zambrano, as I recall, although this is an enormous record, so I may get some of this wrong, was convicted on three counts. He gets three 20-year sentences, and the district court chooses to make them consecutive rather than concurrent. So we've said many times that as long as the sentence for a particular count respects the statutory maximum, that's within the district court's authority.
Yes, Your Honor, but this Mr. Zambrano's case presents a different question in light of the United States Supreme Court's more recent holding in Alene, and that is that in Alene, the court explained that the relevant inquiry is, did the sentencing court's fact-finding authorize a higher sentencing range than those charges which the jury found the defendant guilty of? So we're not just concerned about what is the sentencing result. We're concerned about what is the process by which the sentencing court arrived at that sentence. Here, we contend that the sentencing court found facts that elevated Mr. Zambrano's sentence on the general RICO charge from 20 years maximum imprisonment to a life sentence. And as soon as the district court made...
Only functionally, not in the legal sense. It's functional in a life sentence because the judge ran the sentences consecutive. But it's not a life sentence. It's a 60-year sentence, right?
You're correct, Your Honor. But as soon as a sentencing court makes findings of fact that expose the defendant, that authorize a higher sentence than that which...
On a discretionary basis, not a mandatory basis. The Alene principle has to do with mandatory minimums.
It does have...
And the Apprendi principle has to do with statutory maximums.
Yes, Your Honor.
So your argument
correct.
Would apply to all consecutive sentences then, right?
No. Our argument applies
why not? The consecutiveness increases that range.
No. Our argument applies to situations like Mr. Zambrano's case where the district court makes specific findings that the jury did not find exposing the defendant to a higher statutory sentencing range.
But district courts make findings like that all the time, and as long as they restrict the actual sentence imposed to the one that the statute permits, the finding doesn't have any impact. A district court might find facts such as murder finding that would authorize a life sentence, but as long as the district court imposes only a 20-year sentence, I'm not familiar with any principle that says in the abstract if the finding would allow a greater sentence, then there's a problem.
Well, the principle, Your Honor, respectfully, is the Sixth Amendment. And the Alene court answered this question squarely. At oral argument, Justice Scalia asked a similar question to the petitioner. He asked, well, why should we be concerned with this when the district court could have given this sentence regardless of the judge's fact-finding? And the majority opinion in Alene addressed that question squarely when Justice Thomas wrote that it is no answer to say that the defendant could have gotten the same sentence regardless of the sentencing court's fact-finding. Thus, the relevant inquiry is, the dispositive question is, what is the process by which...
No, the dispositive question is whether the fact-findings have the force of law. And that's the Alene principle. The fact-finding that is done had the force of law in the sense that they dictated the mandatory statutory minimum. When you're talking about the sentencing guidelines, post-Booker, and this is Chief Judge Wood's initial point, post-Booker, this is a discretionary function that the judge is performing. So these fact findings don't have any legal effect. You know, they may affect the judge's exercise of discretion about where to post the sentence, but it doesn't have any legally binding effect, and so we don't have a Sixth Amendment problem.
Right, Your Honor, and I think that was the crux of the Booker case. But in this case, the judge's fact-finding had the effect of exposing Mr. Zambrano to a life sentence, and second of all, he was sentenced to 60 years imprisonment when the jury authorized only a sentence of 20 years imprisonment.
No, but that's not the case. The jury convicted him on several charges, and so the judge exercised his authority to run the sentences consecutively. Now, as I started out, you know, if you are hoping to urge the Supreme Court to extend the principles that it's been working on ever since Apprendi, that's fine. That's your prerogative. We are bound by what they've done so far, and I just don't see how his fact findings exposed Mr. Zambrano to anything as long as the judge respected the statutory maximum and also the statutory minimum. That's not at issue here. The statutory maximum for each of those three counts. And the judge, as far as I can tell, did so, unless you're trying to say that there's a constitutional problem with consecutive sentences under these facts.
No, Your Honor. What we're arguing is that the judge found facts on the general RICO charge that effectively are what led those – that fact-finding is what led to his 60-year sentence.
Well, and I mean, if – right. I mean, if the government had charged him directly for some participation in the murders, there would have been a different guideline. But the government didn't. The government charged him with RICO and the various other things that it charged him for, the extortion conspiracy and so on. And so the judge looks at the guidelines, calculates what the recommended sentence is. It's much more than 20 years, and the judge, as the guidelines permit, achieves the sentencing goal by running the individual sentences consecutively. And it sounds to me like you're really making a frontal attack on that principle.
Well, Your Honor, we're trying to persuade this court that as soon as the judge makes finding of facts that authorize a higher sentencing range than that which was authorized by the jury's findings, that we have a Sixth Amendment problem.
The jury's findings on those counts sets the range, 20 years per count. I think you're overlooking that.
Your Honor, the jury's findings as to the RICO charge, as to count one of the indictment, exposed Mr. Zambrano to a maximum term of 20 years imprisonment. Now, at sentencing, the judge found facts that increased that exposure to a life sentence. The judge at sentencing, the district court here at sentencing, adopted the probation department's pre-sentence investigative report, thereby finding facts that Mr. Zambrano was responsible for murder conduct, including murder, conspiracy to commit murder, attempted murder, conduct that carries a life sentence.
The jury's findings actually authorized a 60-year sentence because there were three 20-year counts, right?
That's correct.
His maximum exposure on the counts of conviction was 60 years.
On all three counts.
And that's what he got.
That's correct.
So what Sixth Amendment violation do we have?
The Sixth Amendment violation is that the judge found facts as to count one.
Jury found the facts. He's subject to 60 years. He got the 60 years. It was richly deserved. And, you know, that's the end of the inquiry. It doesn't really matter how the judge got to the 60 years. He's entitled to impose the full 60.
Well,
and we have a completely discretionary regime after Booker, provided that the judge does what he has to do to calculate the original range, but he can ignore it and impose the maximum sentence on sufficient justification, which exists here. I don't think there's a good argument that this sentence wasn't justified as a reasonable one under the circumstances.
Respectfully, Your Honor, that is not the end of the question. The question in that the court, as the court explained in Alene versus the United States, is...
You're over-reading the case.
you are familiar with the second footnote in that Alene opinion? It seems to address the very argument you're making and rejects it.
Yes, Your Honor.
So do we read that out of the opinion?
And I think you're referring to the footnote where the court says, here's what we're not finding today. If my memory serves.
Juries find facts that increase the statutory maximum or minimum, while such findings of fact may lead, and it goes on, it says, it concludes by saying, while such findings of fact may lead judges to select sentences that are more severe than the ones they would have selected without those facts, Sixth Amendment does not govern that element of sentencing. It lays it out.
Sure, but the sentencing court is still bound by the jury's findings.
Right.
And here,
with respect to the minimum, if there is one, and the maximum. The rest is up to judicial findings.
Yes, Your Honor, but both Alleyn and Apprendi also stand for the idea that we're concerned with judicial fact-finding at sentencing, and the reason for that is because judicial fact-finding at sentencing is fertile ground for the kind of sentencing manipulation that the guidelines rail against.
So we have to go a step or two or more beyond the cases to get where you are.
No, I think these questions are addressed squarely in the cases. As I said before, I think that that Justice Thomas, in the majority opinion, addressed this question head-on when he said that it's no answer to say that the defendant could have been sentenced to sentence X absent the fact that the district court found. Mr. Zambrano's case presents it's a clear case of the kind of sentencing manipulation. And when I say sentencing manipulation, I mean that a district court's fact findings, as I said before, is fertile ground for the government to shift its burden from proof beyond a reasonable doubt to proof by a preponderance of the evidence at sentencing.
That might be true if the fact finding had some legally binding effect on the sentence, because it doesn't, you know, this argument doesn't implicate the Sixth Amendment.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, we believe it does, as soon as the district court made findings that increased Mr. Zambrano's exposure.
It did. He had exposure of 60 years.
He had exposure
by virtue of the jury's findings.
Your Honor, he had exposure to 60 years on all three counts, but the judge exposed him, the sentencing court exposed him to a life sentence on one count.
But that's not what happened. Let me just recommend, since this is going to be a long morning, Mr. Altman, if you want some rebuttal time, you might want to consider saving some.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Your Honors, co-counsel, may it please the Court. My name is Justina Chauvet, and I will be arguing the issue of Pinkerton, the Pinkerton instruction given to the jury on behalf of the trial defendant. The Pinkerton instruction, which was given to the jury, did not include the language, the second part, or the beyond the reasonable doubt language that was given to the jury. And this was error. The government agrees that this was error. And it was a fundamental error, a structural error, which, if it's a structural error, we don't have to even prove there was a harmless. We don't prove it was harmless.
So that's where I think we should focus, because I, like you, understand the government to be admitting that it was error to admit that second part of the Pinkerton instruction. But under the Nader case, instructional errors are normally not structural errors. They're subject to harmless error review. And if we move into harmless error territory, we see with respect to at least most of the defendants that there is direct liability anyway. You don't really even need Pinkerton. And with respect to the others, these instructions do refer to reasonable doubt repeatedly. So I'm not sure that needs to be, that it's actually harmful in this particular context. So maybe you could talk about Nader a little bit and harmless error.
Well, as far as the harmless error, I do think it was, there was harm, because even though on the first point, though there was given, I agree, there was giving beyond a reasonable doubt language in many other places. But then, well, maybe I should go back, because I disagree with you that because there were substantive counts, and because they could have found, the jury could have found through a direct route, through the direct way, through going through the elements, finding what was, were they Atlantic kings, were they this, all that. But they also could have found through the Pinkerton, because there are many, there's the two conspiracies, both the drug and the RICO conspiracy. They could have gone first through the Pinkerton, and they could have looked at that. And on many of these accounts, they are not, they're not, in my case with Mr. Garcia, he has accused of these counts, but he was with a co-conspirator.
You represent Mr. Vicente Garcia?
I'm Mr. Vicente Garcia. But many of these, you could have gone through the path of direct, but you could have also gone through the pretrial. And if the beyond reasonable doubt language was given, then that would have been okay to do. But here, we don't have that. So how do we know that the jury didn't focus through the Pinkerton path? They wouldn't have had to find the beyond the reasonable doubt. Then you have these people convicted of these counts back through the Pinkerton. And then basically, the beyond reasonable doubt has not been applied, and it's not a legal, correct, appropriate way to do it. Secondly, your other concern about, well, they were given the beyond reasonable doubt in multiple occasions. Well, I compare this to if you have three recipes. Two of the recipes tell you, you must follow this recipe, you must put the baking soda in those recipes. The third recipe says, you don't have to put the baking soda.
But that's not what this half Pinkerton instruction said.
Well, it did not put...
It just omitted the reasonable doubt.
It omitted the reasonable doubt,
but
which...
What reason do we have to think that the jury all of a sudden thought with respect to this Pinkerton issue that reasonable doubt didn't apply? I mean, they were told over and over again that the reasonable doubt standard is what applies all the way through. It's the government's burden. There just isn't really a reasonable reason to think that they would have suspended the reasonable doubt burden for purposes of evaluating the Pinkerton issue.
Well, I just
this instruction as it stood,
I disagree,
given
with you, Your
in
Honor.
Sort of the half sense, didn't tell the jury what to do with this principle, frankly. I mean, so the defendants really had the benefit of the muddied waters here.
I disagree with you, Your Honor, because if they see it everywhere else, that's even more but it's more of a outstanding. If you see it everywhere else and you don't see it there, why do you assume right away that they said, oh, it's there, it must be there? If we presume that they follow what they are...
You're not contending, though, that the government took advantage of this gap and argued that something less than beyond reasonable doubt would allow a conviction?
Well, what I'm saying is that the instruction that was given never had the second part of that.
But you're not...
Excuse me?
The government didn't exploit that.
Well...
Did they stand up and say... preponderate? I mean, they didn't do anything like that.
Well, they didn't. They never gave the appropriate Pinkerton instruction.
Right, but in argument, did the government ever suggest that their burden with respect to accountability would be less than beyond a reasonable doubt?
No, they didn't say that right out, but the very fact that they did not include it, I think it does say to them, you don't have to find it.
But I'm not sure it does. I think it depends a lot on the language of the rest of the instructions, because one of the ways I look at this problem is to ask myself, how often does the district court have to say this? After every sentence or after every instruction? And it's my understanding that in the instructions, the district court says, it is the government's burden to prove everything beyond a reasonable doubt. So why the jury would think everything means less than everything, I don't know. But that's my issue here.
Well, I still think it's a problem because...
But they did. They were told the government has to prove everything beyond a reasonable doubt. Were they not?
They were told in many places, yes.
Yeah, okay.
But they were not told in the Pinkerton instruction.
So there's an omission in the Pinkerton instruction, but you're not saying that after every sentence the judge has to say, and this is beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, in the Pinkerton instruction, in the pattern, it is in there. And
oh,
why
I agree, and it should have been done. I have no idea why it wasn't done, and the government should be castigated for creating this appeal issue. But if we're in the harmless error analysis, we do have to look and see whether this conceded mistake of not following or not using belt and suspenders or whatever you want to say made a difference, as Nader explains that concept.
Well, as far as that, if in a case of this where I just want to say, in a case of this where you have multiple conspiracies, you have people charged with a substantive count, but they also have multiple conspiracies. If you've already decided, and we don't know, this is the assumption that we're assuming that the jury did say this is beyond a reasonable doubt. But how do we know they assume this? And this is something that we do not know as defendants, the government does not know, and this court has even said we do not know. And in United States versus Robinson, which was just decided in July, this court reversed because they said that we did not know. We cannot assume that that limiting instruction.
Was that a different situation?
It's a different situation in that there was a conflict between the oral instructions and the written instructions, and I think it could have, the court found it could have confused the jury as to what they were supposed to do. There's no conflict. I mean, we have instructions throughout. You have to find beyond a reasonable doubt. There's an omission, which is consistent as between the oral and the written instructions. I'm not sure Robinson.
Well, I find this situation. I do think it's. I find this situation even. Worse, because at least there they were given a written and a set of instructions.
Was Robinson plain error review?
No, it was not plain error review. This is not plain error review either, because we objected to this instruction. And I believe that
you objected to this part, the absence of the beyond a reasonable doubt part of it?
Yes. Yes, we did. We objected at the jury instruction conference, and the judge overruled it. If any more questions, I see my time is run out. I would like to
save
a few minutes
for your rebuttal, certainly.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning. So may it please the court. I represent defendant appellant Javier Ramirez in this case. And the question I want to focus on is whether or not gang membership by itself makes a defendant accountable for another gang member's criminal act. And the law is clear that it doesn't.
Why is this a gang membership by itself case, particularly with regard to Mr. Ramirez, but in general? It seems to me the government had a lot of evidence of common goals, of extortionate action, of drug sales, of other things that were coordinated through the organization known as the Latin Kings.
Well, certainly the government did have evidence of some criminal acts that were committed by Latin Kings that were in furtherance of the ultimate RICO conspiracy that Mr. Ramirez pled guilty to. However, I would like to address the finding that Mr. Ramirez is accountable for the 2007 murder that the court found him accountable for at sentencing.
So he's an Inca, right?
He was, yes.
Yeah, or was an Inca.
He was an Inca. However, that title and that role in itself does not make him accountable for every act of violence within his territory, within the Little Village section of the Latin Kings.
But wasn't the jury instructed to find, number one, that he agreed, he joined the conspiracy, and number two, that its actions were reasonably foreseeable to him?
Well, Mr. Ramirez pled guilty. So he did not.
Right, that's right. But so he pleads guilty to that. He pleads guilty to the fact that he joins the conspiracy and the acts are reasonably foreseeable.
However, there still needs to be a finding that the particular act was committed in furtherance of that conspiracy. And in Mr. Ramirez's case, this murder, there's simply no evidence that it was committed in
the
furtherance.
The Pierce murder, right?
Correct.
I thought he's on tape saying that his guys committed this murder. And it was, it's, profanity laden and coded in the language of the gang, but the implication, or at least one logical inference and reasonable inference from what he said on tape, was that this was all part and parcel of the security operation of the hood, which he was in charge of, and that his guys shot and killed somebody who shouldn't have been there.
Well, you're correct that he was on tape discussing the fact that he had served as an accessory after the fact to murder, that some of his guys had committed the murder and that he had hidden them after the fact. And he was punished for that.
But there's also evidence to show that the murders are part of the method of doing business. This is all about using the cross-reference in the guidelines, right, for his sentence.
Correct.
But that was his job, so to speak. The jury could so conclude from the evidence that was in the record. The judge at sentencing could so conclude.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree. I don't think that the judge could conclude from the evidence in the record of this particular murder that this murder was committed in furtherance of this conspiracy's goals.
But there's other evidence about the structure of the Latin Kings and real particularity about that structure and who's responsible for what and so forth. So that plays into it, doesn't it?
I don't think it does in this case, in this particular instance, Your Honor. We are not arguing reasonable foreseeability or the fact that Mr. Ramirez wasn't in this conspiracy. What we're saying is this is a random murder, and the evidence shows it occurred after a verbal spat that was particularized to two people. It was a random act of violence that the record is simply replete with any evidence to show that it was to protect the hood, or that these victims were rival gang members, or it had any relation to furthering the Latin Kings' goals. It was a random act of violence.
Well, that's one interpretation. Another interpretation, given the background evidence about how the gang operates and what the Inca's role is and what the role of the peewees, I guess they're called, or whatever people who are responsible for holding the guns and keeping security on the street, and who they report to in the chain of command, all of that background evidence provides a strong basis to infer that this was in furtherance of the conspiracy.
Well, respectfully,
you can interpret it in another way, too, but the judge doesn't have to interpret it in a way that's favorable to the defendant.
Well, the judge does not have to. You're right. However, in this case, there was not enough evidence to find him, to hold Mr. Ramirez accountable.
To the preponderance standard?
As I argue in my brief, we would argue that it's a beyond a reasonable doubt standard. However, even if you apply the lower standard, there's not enough evidence. And if you review the cases where this court has decided whether or not an act is committed in furtherance of a conspiracy, you'll see that the evidence in this case is completely different than in those cases. I would turn your attention to United States versus Curtis. There was testimony that the victim who was killed in that case was stealing from the criminal organization. Clearly, there's a strong inference then that murder was committed in furtherance of that conspiracy. In United States versus Thompson, the person killed was an informant who was killed because he was talking to the police about the criminal organization. In United States versus Morales, the victims were killed because they were believed to be rival gang members. Here, we have no such evidence. The only evidence we have is that there was a verbal spat between two people, and this was a tragic random act of violence.
But we do have evidence that the Latin Kings were sending people out into the neighborhood at night to protect the territory. They had all these rules about don't speed down. I thought the traffic rules were kind of strange, but don't speed down the street and protect the neighborhood, protect the territory, protect the reputation. And as Judge Sykes commented, this statement explaining the murder from Mr. Ramirez himself, that doesn't sound at all like an after-the-fact participation. It sounds like he's saying, yeah, this is what we do. We protect our turf, and these guys drove over here, and they were invading somehow.
Well, I would disagree with you. I don't think that his statement says or conveys that he believed the murder was committed because these people were invading the turf. Certainly he harbored one of the offenders after the fact, and he was punished for that. It increased his guideline range, and it was found to be a predicate RICO act at sentencing. However, if you're referring to the so-called mandatory bust outs, which is talked about a lot in the government's brief, there's evidence that this murder wasn't committed during those time frames.
Right. It was a different time of day, I remember. But there was a broader goal that each Inca was supposed to protect his little territory, right?
Correct. There was. However, the fact that goal existed does not mean that every single criminal act within that territory was committed in furtherance of the conspiracy. Certainly a shoplifting within that territory wouldn't be committed in furtherance of the conspiracy. And just because the Latin King enterprise was a violent and destructive organization does not mean that every single violent crime was committed in furtherance of their conspiracy, no matter how despicable these crimes were.
Well, if there were no evidence linking it, I would agree, but his statement does. It's a murder that's committed on his turf by his soldiers, talks about it with other people. He hides the shooter afterwards. Why isn't that enough on a preponderance standard for the judge to infer that this was something within the scope of the overall conspiracy?
It's certainly enough for the judge to infer that Mr. Ramirez was an accessory after the fact to the murder, and perhaps that the offender was a Latin King, and that Mr. Ramirez felt allegiance to him and tried to protect him. However, there is nothing in that statement to show that this murder was committed because the victims were rival gang members, were invading the Latin King's so-called territory, or posed a threat to the Latin King organization, either real or perceived. There's nothing in the record that this murder was anything more than spontaneous and random. And just because, like I said, the Latin King organization was a violent one, not every single violent crime committed within Latin King territory was in furtherance of their conspiracy. I see my time is up. I'd like to reserve the remaining. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel for the government, and my co-counsel. My name is Susan Pavlo, and I represent Sam Gutierrez, and he is appealing the denial of acceptance of responsibility following his plea of guilty. In this case, Mr. Gutierrez certainly admitted that he was an Inca in the Latin King organization. He admitted that he dealt drugs, that he extorted people, that he used guns to protect the neighborhood, and that he knew shootings would happen. Even admitting all of that, the district court still denied acceptance of responsibility. So he was in a position to simply sort of guess what more could he have given. He gave all that he possibly could. And while acceptance of responsibility is routinely granted for, you know, far less detail, what this case really highlights is the different standards that the district court imposed among the defendants, particularly when you're comparing Mr. Gutierrez's sentencing with that of co-defendant Felipe Zamora. Zamora was in a similar position. He pled blind, admitted to drug dealing and extortion. Sentencing, the government also contended that he should not be given acceptance of responsibility. So it's clear that in comparing the two sentencing transcripts, that the district court really relied on the allocutions of both defendants in deciding whether he should give acceptance or not give acceptance. Now, looking at Mr. Zamora's allocution, it's a nice allocution, but he doesn't give any specific detail about his leadership role, about his daily activities. He doesn't mention the words violence or shootings. And when that's all said and done, the district court indicated that Mr. Zamora actually articulated quite well what he did in the gang.
So the district court, I mean, I have some concerns about Mr. Gutierrez's sentence. The district court does find that he's remorseful, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And there was a portion at the sentencing hearing where he became overwhelmed and was emotional, and we had to take a break.
And the district court seems to think that he hasn't admitted to the violence sufficiently?
That seems to be the district court's assertion. I would certainly take issue with that because it was indicated first through counsel that he understood on page 22 of the sentencing transcript that in pleading guilty that murder conspiracy was a reasonably foreseeable consequence. But more than that, Mr. Gutierrez himself actually said, I had guns, we used it to protect the neighborhood, I knew that shootings would happen.
So does that involve our accepting this correction to the transcript that you've suggested where he said that where the transcript says he knew violence surely happens and I knew that would happen as opposed to I knew that shootings happened and would happen?
I think that's a potential problem, Your Honor. I don't know what the district court heard. I know in the government's brief they indicate shootings, and so if that's what they heard, that's what they heard. But I know what the transcript says, and then there's the
Well, he admits that he knew shootings happened. That would be a plus for him, I take it.
Correct. And I think based on the way the transcript is written with that attachment at the end, you're not quite sure, and I think that alone certainly gives a reason to send it back to the district court to consider the acceptance of responsibility.
Now, for the other defendants, the district court didn't require a point-by-point statement about the violence, didn't require, you know, then on this day I did this violent thing or somebody else on my behalf did that violent thing. It was the same kind of general admission for the other defendants.
And then I would say that Mr. Gutierrez then was unfortunately held to a different standard and one that he shouldn't be. I think there should be a fundamental baseline of fairness in applying acceptance of responsibility. And as I said, he was pled guilty, avoided a trial, had no violations on pretrial release.
Now, this sounds to me mostly like the version of argument, which we accept sometimes, perfectly reasonable argument, that the district court's explanation for refusing the acceptance discount was not adequate under these circumstances. He could wind up with the same sentence again if we were to agree with you and send it back.
Certainly,
even if the court granted acceptance, the court would be entitled to go above. And if the court said, no, I really meant not to give acceptance because here's a particular fact about Mr. Gutierrez not mentioned yet, but now I'm going to say it, that causes me to deny it.
Certainly that's possible, but with all due respect, I think that's a bit speculative at this point. I mean, what we do know is the district court said that Mr. Gutierrez did not use the word murder conspiracy from his own lips, but neither did another defendant. And certainly he said that he didn't feel that Mr. Gutierrez's allocution met the requirements in his eyes, but it is somewhat confounding when you look at the allocutions of another co-defendant, and they simply seem to be two different standards.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, I think you can also consider that I see I'm into my rebuttal time.
Well, if I could follow up on that, though, as I understand the chronology and reading between the lines of what the district court did say, Mr. Gutierrez tried to escape responsibility for these murders initially and before sentencing and sought to avoid being tagged with that responsibility in the sentencing decision. And then once the judge made findings with respect to some other similarly situated defendants about responsibility for these murders, he attempted to retract that at sentencing. And as I understand the judge's decision, he didn't think that was sufficient to warrant the acceptance of responsibility reduction because of the chronology, the shifting positions, basically, is how I read the judge's concern, that there was a change of heart when he realized his argument was a loser. And that's a valid basis to withhold the adjustment.
First, he did not indicate that that was his basis for doing so. But even reading between the lines, the objection that was made very clearly stated it was a legal one. But then you're also back to the problem of Mr. Zamora made the same objection. He also made the same withdrawal, and he still got acceptance.
Right, so but then we get into the difference of the elocution, which is a very subtle thing and the kind of thing that we defer heavily to the district court who's there, you know, face-to-face with the defendants and deciding in a qualitative basis or on a qualitative basis and a holistic basis whether the remorse and acceptance of responsibility is real. And that's very hard for us to evaluate on the basis of a cold transcript. And I think while he did credit your client with some remorse, he also said that it was basically a sense of having betrayed his family and his friends, not so much an acknowledgement of the damage done to victims in the community.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think it was all that subtle in this case, because everything he wanted to hear from Mr. Gutierrez, quite frankly, he didn't hear from Mr. Zamora. Mr. Zamora made absolutely no comment about his daily activity, about shootings, about violence, and then for whatever reason the district court decided that was a very eloquent allocution, and Mr. Gutierrez made much more in terms of a factual admission and detail, and for whatever reason the district court did not grant him the acceptance. And I think that that is
isn't that one of those subjective things, though, that we would ordinarily need to defer to the district court? We're not in the courtroom listening to what's said and evaluating it on the level of whether it's genuine and real.
In this case, no, because when you look at the transcript, and I understand it's a cold transcript, you can't say one defendant doesn't give me enough detail and another defendant who gives me much less, he can get the acceptance. It's simply a matter of fairness, I would submit.
Okay,
and with that,
thank
I'm
you.
Out of time. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bill Stanton. I represent Felipe Zamora in this case. Mr. Zamora entered a blind plea of guilty and proceeded to sentencing. At the sentencing, we believe the district court made several errors that affected the integrity of the proceeding and prejudiced Mr. Zamora. Chiefly among those, the district court committed procedural error when it improperly calculated the guidelines range in this case. It was the defense's position that the appropriate range was 168 to 210 months, which would be a offense level of 33 and a criminal history category of 3. The government posited that it should be a range of 235 months to 293 months, which would be a total offense level of 36 at a criminal history category of 3. In the written judgment in this case, the court put the range at 168 months to 235 months, and that's in Section 3 of the Statement of Reasons.
Right. I saw that, and there is, of course, no such range, so that's a mistake.
That's a mistake, and we believe that the district court improperly combined two ranges here, and we think that's important because was this sentence 5 months higher than the range, or was it 30 months higher than the range?
Right.
And the district court never articulated what the range was at sentencing.
Right. I looked through the sentencing transcript, and I could see counsel discussing what the two different ranges would be. Defense counsel 168 to 210, the government the higher range. But I didn't find any place where the district court said, I'm settling on one or the other.
Now,
aside from this this erroneous account of what an offense level 33 and a criminal history of 3 would be.
And I think the government's position is that the district court did accept that Mr. Zamora received acceptance of responsibility. By accepting that, they accepted the probation officer's report and that the range was 168 to 210 months. But without ever articulating that and with a clearly erroneous written statement in the judgment, I don't think we can assume that.
Well, it's a reasonable inference, but even if we didn't and there was a mistake, the question is harm. This was clearly a non-guideline sentence, and once the judge decides to issue a non-guideline sentence, he doesn't have to justify it to the guidelines range.
Well, yes, but did the judge mean to give him 5 months over the top
end?
That
doesn't matter. The judge does not have to evaluate a non-guideline sentence and justify it with respect to the range. It just has to be a reasonable sentence, and it has to be adequately explained.
But he does have to provide the adequate explanation.
But not vis-a-vis the range.
Correct.
So once, I mean, there may have been a mistake on the part of the judge in not articulating on the record which range he was accepting, although it may be reasonable to infer that he was adopting the one offered by the pre-sentence report. But even assuming there was a mistake, it's not harmful here because it's so clear the judge was issuing a non-guideline sentence, and it doesn't matter whether it was 5 months or 30 months outside the range because it doesn't have to be explained with respect to the range.
Well, I think that initial mistake was exacerbated by the fact that in explaining a justification for the sentence in this case, the judge hung his hat on the fact that the Latin Kings were a violent organization.
But you do have to start with an accurate calculation of the range. The Supreme Court has made that clear.
And it's procedural error not to.
That's right. And in Pew and other cases, they've said it's really a problem if you don't start with an accurate calculation of the range.
Correct. And when the inaccurate calculation is combined with the fact that the judge, in justifying its sentence here, said Latin Kings are evil and violent and barbaric, which are all things that were...
That's probably true.
...and inherent in the offenses that were charged, there's no particular rationale as to why Felipe Zamora deserved that sentence in this case.
Well, there could well be many reasons. I think the only point you really have is that from a procedural point of view, not from a substantive reasonableness of his sentence, but from a procedural point of view, A, the guidelines have to be calculated correctly, and B, there needs to be an adequate, whatever that is, an adequate explanation on the part of the district court judge for the sentence he has selected.
Right, and we believe the former absolutely occurred in this case. There was procedural error in not calculating correctly. We also believe there was some substantive error as well.
The question is, what's the harm?
I think the harm is manifest that Mr. Zamora received a sentence that was much higher than was deserved.
Vis-a-vis the range or the crimes?
The facts of the case.
So the sentence was unreasonable?
Yes.
Well, for harm, I mean, the Supreme Court has said that there is reversible error if there's a procedural problem in the calculation of the guidelines.
Right.
And even though a properly calculated guideline might lead to the same sentence, so it's a little difficult to apply harmless error here.
And the sentence is discretionary, but I think it should be remanded for that reevaluation by the district court.
I'm not saving anything. Ms. Sansonetti?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Gabrielle Sansonetti. I represent Mr. Alfonso Chavez, and this morning I am before you to argue that Mr. Chavez's experience with the criminal justice system was replete with errors throughout. Specifically, I'd like to address the fact that Mr. Chavez was a 23-year-old young man when he joined the Latin King Street Gang. That is indisputable. But he was a low-level, temporary Inca, and much of the evidence for which the government presented for the strength and the violence of the gang simply does not apply to Mr. Chavez in the same way that it applies to his co-defendants.
But you don't become an Inca just by strolling into the room. I mean, he'd been involved with the gang for a long time, presumably, to be entrusted with that leadership responsibility.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I would disagree. There was evidence in the record, testimony by government witnesses, that there were sections that struggled and had weak membership. There was absolutely no evidence that Mr. Chavez had participated in the gang prior to this point, including the government's own witnesses, Mr. Shanna, who had been in the gang for 15 years, who served as a high-level leader in a nearby section of Mr. Chavez's, and yet had never met Mr. Chavez prior to this first recording. Similarly, Jesse Guajardo, who was also a member of the gang for 15 years and a high-level leader and rose through the ranks through most of his young adult life, had never met Mr. Chavez
but
prior to this moment or ever.
I mean, focusing on what we have, though, the evidence of his participation in the conspiracy to distribute cocaine is evidence that can be accepted.
Your Honor, the evidence about his participation to distribute cocaine, I believe, is very weak as a matter of fact.
The jury is entitled to decide what weight to put on Mr. Shannon's testimony.
Well, I believe that the jury wasn't given all of the tools to make a proper decision. The jury never received a buyer-seller instruction, and
it wasn't requested.
It was not, but I believe that it was argued by Mr. Chavez's counsel, and the fact that the district court did not sua sponte offer the buyer-seller instruction under United States versus Gee, this can be reversible error when the evidence is so
bad. Well, it's a plain error standard. I mean, this was a huge trial. To criticize the district court when, to all appearances, it looked like Mr. Chavez is on the same side of the transaction anyway.
Your Honor, I would disagree that Mr. Chavez is on the same side of the transaction. Mr. Chavez, in fact, took no extra action other than the purchase of the cocaine to assist in the distribution of the cocaine. He did not look out for police. He did not offer to bag cocaine. He did not offer to find buyers for it. In fact, there's zero evidence.
But he got information about, 24 others being in the same position as him on this program over the course of several weeks where they would get so much a week.
It's correct, Your Honor.
Made aware of that.
To be clear, the record is clear that Mr. Chavez did not participate. There was apparently a meeting early on in the distribution effort where this distribution effort was explained to the Incas. Mr. Chavez was not a part of that meeting and did not enter the distribution conspiracy until halfway through. In addition,
have on tape him being told that 24 others are getting this?
Yes, and to be clear, Your Honor, that exchange between Mr. Chavez and Mr. Shana involved Mr. Shana saying, you know, there's 24 others doing this. And Mr. Chavez granting a uncommittal affirmative yes to the statement rather than actual the knowledge of what Mr. Shannon was specifically speaking of. It's very weak evidence, in my view. I see my time is up if there's any other questions.
Apparently not. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Georgia Alexakis, and I represent the United States. None of the issues raised by the appellants today warrant reversing their convictions or vacating their sentences. I'll begin with one of the last issues raised by the appellants, specifically Mr. Chavez's contention that the government failed to present sufficient evidence to sustain his conviction for participating in a drug distribution conspiracy. The trial evidence allowed the jury to infer that Mr. Chavez was, in fact, a member of that conspiracy, that he had a so-called stake in the venture. And that stake in the venture is what distinguishes membership in a drug distribution conspiracy from a mere buyer-seller relationship. What is the evidence? How do we know that Mr. Chavez had a stake in that drug distribution venture? Well, he was a Latin king, like all the other members of the drug distribution conspiracy. And this circuit has never found a buyer-seller relationship to exist between fellow gang members. Instead, that relationship is typically reserved for situations in which the parties are unaffiliated, except for the fact that they have drug-related transactions.
I'm not sure that had a buyer-seller instruction been requested, it should have been rejected in these circumstances. You're suggesting one interpretation, there might have been another. But since we're on plain error review, it's not clear to me that the district judge should have reached out and given one, given the nature of these facts.
I agree with that, Judge. In fact, under United States v. Gee, which counsel for Mr. Chavez cited, the circuit held that a buyer-seller instruction, a district court is obligated to give a buyer-seller instruction sua sponte only in cases where the evidence of a drug distribution conspiracy is so weak. In that particular case, the evidence was so weak that it didn't even satisfy a preponderance of the evidence standard. Here, we have appellants who are conceding that the government proved the existence of a drug distribution conspiracy. And so Gee doesn't apply. District court should not have sua sponte given a buyer-seller instruction. and an instruction was otherwise not requested.
I mean, it could have. It just, well, I think it could have, but the argument, the only thing you need to say is that there was no compulsion for it to do that. There's no plain error unless this was the only thing, in a sense, that could have happened.
Correct. There was no error by the district court in that respect. And so Mr. Chavez's contention appears to be that the government, although the government proved that there was a drug distribution conspiracy in place, the government failed to prove that he was a knowing member of that conspiracy.
Okay. If I could just turn your attention to two aspects of this case that trouble me, I'll just tell you what they are. First of all, they are Mr. Zamora's sentence, given the error on the judgment form and the failure of the district court on the record ever to state in a clear fashion which guidelines range he is adopting. We know that we have to start with an accurate calculation of the guidelines range, and if the judge makes a mistake by thinking it's broader than it is, that's still a mistaken range. So I'm concerned about Mr. Zamora's sentence, and I'm also concerned about Mr. Gutierrez's sentence, in that I am very hard-pressed to see the explanation for why the judge is evaluating him differently from Mr. Zamora. One can dream up things, but we have a lot of cases where we say it's not up to us to dream up the explanation. We need to hear from the sentencing judge the reason for the choice. So those are the two aspects of this case that concern me.
Yes, Your Honor, and I'll start with the Zamora sentencing issue. In Mr. Zamora's sentencing, the district court did, in fact, calculate a guidelines range and did so
where?
Properly.
Show me where.
There is no word in the transcript, in the sentencing hearing transcript, in which the district court uses the words 168 to 210 months.
What are you looking at? I went through this a million times. I see, you know, counsel talking. I see when the district court says, I accept the pre-sentence investigation report, that normally means the facts that the PSR has pulled together. So what's your best evidence from this sentencing transcript?
My best evidence, Your Honor, is the district court's clear decision.
Give me a page. I mean, I don't find anything clear about it, so you're not going to persuade me by talking about the clear decision.
I would point you to Government Appendix 541.
Well, I don't have
sentencing transcript.
Is that part of the transcript that's attached to his brief?
It is in Volume 2 of the government's appendix.
Right, which is down in my chambers.
But what page again?
It's Government Appendix 541. And then if you give me a moment, Chief Judge Wood, I will look in my brief. I believe that there's I can find for you the page where the particular language appears in the brief.
Great.
I had my good picture that I walked up there.
So all this says is you are granting the defendant the reduction for acceptance of responsibility. The court, that is correct. I have taken that into account. He should get the credit. But I don't see anything where he says the sentencing range is X months to Y months. When you get over to the actual judgment form, we find the mistake.
Correct. There is a mistake in the judgment and conviction.
And if the judge thinks, see, I'm thinking of all these Supreme Court decisions that say, of course the judge has discretion over sentencing, 3553A, all of that, but we need to start with a correctly calculated guidelines range. And if the judge thinks the top of the range is 235 months, he's just flat wrong.
But there are two cases in this circuit, Anarano and Robinson, that sanction what the district court did here. In Anarano, this circuit found that
making a mistake in the guideline range calculation?
Respectfully, Judge, I don't think that the district court made a mistake in the guidelines range. What we have here...
He did. He never, in either orally or in any other way, articulates the correct range.
And Anarano and Robinson don't require him to do that. In Anarano, the district court never said the magic words, what exactly the guidelines range was.
But the district court there adopted the pre-sentence report, and the circuit found that that was not, because it was clear from the pre-sentence report what the guidelines range should be, the district court in Anarano had not committed any error.
But the difference, well, there are a couple of things. First of all, the Supreme Court keeps coming out with decisions about the importance of starting with the right guidelines range. And secondly, a situation of conflict is different from a situation where the only thing out there is an indirect reference to a guidelines range.
I don't think the reference, though, here was indirect. We have a situation here where the government...
There's a conflict, then.
There is a conflict between the sentencing range that the district court decided upon at sentencing by...
crediting. You think the district court decided on, even though the district court gets it wrong when he writes it all down. I can tell absolutely from this sentence that he thinks he's giving an above-range sentence. He checks all the correct boxes. He explains the reason is the violent nature of the offense. He checks the box again above the advisory guideline range. But if you start from the wrong range, the Supreme Court has told us, we don't know how that would affect the exercise of the discretion in picking the ultimate sentence.
I understand, but I don't think that the district court here began with the wrong range. We have a situation here where the government articulated or advocated for a range of 235 to 293 months without acceptance of responsibility.
I know.
Then we have a situation in which the defendant argued that he deserved acceptance of responsibility, and with that credit for acceptance of responsibility, his guidelines range would be 168 to 210 months.
That's right.
The district court clearly
blends the two of them in an inappropriate way.
The district court blended the two in the judgment and conviction, but at sentencing, during the sentencing hearing, he clearly credits the defendant with acceptance of responsibility.
That much is clear. He does clearly credit him for acceptance of responsibility. What we have deafening silence on is what he thinks the guideline range is.
But
we don't have him saying it's 168 to 210 because I've given acceptance of responsibility.
That is true. But in Robinson, the other Seventh Circuit case that I cited earlier, the district court similarly did not articulate a particular guideline range. And instead, the circuit there found, again, no error, because what they found was that there was only one factual issue in dispute at that particular defendant's sentencing. Similarly, here, there was one factual issue of dispute in Mr. Zamora's sentencing, whether he deserved credit for acceptance of responsibility.
But what is going to happen to the structure of sentencing? The government should have said, you know, just for the record, you know, could you summarize your findings or something like that? We could have guideline ranges all over the block, and nobody will know whether the district court is thinking of the right thing as a reference, whether the district court isn't. You know, you're assuming a lot, especially in a trial this complicated, this long, this many people. I mean, it was a terrible job the district court had to keep all this straight.
I believe the government here did try to clarify the guidelines range by asking specifically at the end, toward the end of the sentencing hearing, they specifically asked, for the record, are you crediting Mr. Zamora with acceptance of responsibility? And so by seeking clarification that one factual issue had in fact been decided by the district court, the government implicitly clarified that the range that Mr. Zamora, that the district court was applying to Mr. Zamora was the 168 to 210 month range.
Well, then we have no explanation at all why after giving him acceptance of responsibility, he goes right back to the sentence that would have been appropriate under the government's view where he gets no acceptance of responsibility.
He gives him a 200.
There has to be an explanation based on 3553A, based on something. We're saying, even though I'm giving you acceptance of responsibility, I think the violence outweighs all of your remorse. I mean, something. Throw us a bone, basically.
And you're right, Chief Judge. The district court did not frame or phrase
not
his sentencing
word.
Rationale that way.
Not
but
a word.
He did provide reasons as to why he was giving Mr. Zamora the sentence that he gave him. He went through and talked about the violent nature of the Latin Kings. He talked about Mr. Zamora being a principal leader within the Latin Kings. He talked about the fact that Mr. Zamora had pleaded guilty to two very serious crimes,
participation in a RICO conspiracy and extortion, and he adopted the government's arguments with respect to Mr. Zamora's role in extorting the Maqueros.
If only he had said, actually, I think the guidelines are useless here. I'm just going to pick a sentence out of the air. Even that would have been better than what he did. He never says he's setting the guidelines aside, as is his discretion to do, no question about that. We don't get any hints. And district judges are under an obligation to address the principal sentencing arguments that defendants have, and he doesn't.
Respectfully, I disagree. The principal sentencing argument here between Mr. Zamora and the government was whether Mr. Zamora should be credited with acceptance of responsibility. And that issue was clearly addressed by the district court. He settled upon, in deciding to give Mr. Zamora acceptance of responsibility, the district court inherently settled upon a 168 to 210-month guideline range. And then he provided reasons to substantiate the 240-month sentence that he did end up giving Mr. Zamora, thus making it a substantively reasonable sentence under Section 3553A.
Your argument would be fine with me if he had explained more and if he had written down 168 to 210. If he thinks he's just bumping it up by 5 months to account for the violent nature, that's one thing. If you think guidelines should be any kind of point of reference, and maybe they shouldn't be, but the Supreme Court says they should be.
I understand, but I would, again,
have a point of reference. It's an accurate one here.
Again, Judge, I would point back to Anarano and Robinson, which hold that a district...
These are different situations. They do not involve the kind of error that we have here.
Perhaps you'd like to address the Bartlett case.
The Bartlett case?
In which this court said that the judge does not need to explain a non-guideline sentence with respect to the range.
That is correct, Judge Sykes. In general, the circuit has held that a sentence doesn't need to be justified as being an above guideline.
The Supreme Court has said that, too. My concern is when the Supreme Court has also said, perhaps contradictorily, that you need to start with an accurate range before you go on to talk about the sentence. Yes, it's true that, you know, if the judge wanted to impose a 300-month sentence on him, forgetting about statutory issues, I presume the judge could have done that. But when you start with a miscalculated range, that's my concern. Then the Bartlett principle doesn't come into play because there's a prior issue.
And the government maintains that there was no procedural error here because by deciding that Mr. Zamora should be credited or was in fact credited with acceptance of responsibility, the district court adopted the 168 to 210-month range. I'm afraid that's the best answer I can give you.
Well, let's move on to Mr. Gutierrez.
Just before we leave that point, because this raises a really important question of tension in both the Supreme Court's case law and in our case law about how to evaluate a guidelines miscalculation if the judge gives a non-guidelines sentence. We know from Bartlett that if there's a guidelines miscalculation and the judge thinks that he's sentencing within the range, then that's reversible error. The open question is whether there's a guidelines miscalculation and the judge sentences outside the range, as it should have been calculated, whether that's reversible error or whether that's subject to a harmless error analysis. And I read language in Bartlett and other cases to say that once the judge resolves on a non-guideline sentence, that even if there was an error in the guidelines calculation, it might not be reversible error if it's clear that the judge was giving a non-guideline sentence for independently justifiable reasons, and the judge explained that sentence. It does not have to be explained vis-a-vis a properly calculated range.
And I think that that's right here, Judge. I think what
Does the government really want to take that position, though? Because the number of upward shifts is lower than the number of downward shifts. And the position the government usually takes is that the guidelines continue under the jurisprudence we now have to play an important, although not dispositive, role in sentencing. So if you want to take the position that the guidelines are out the window every time a judge decides to go below, which is the other kind of non-guidelines sentence that occurs, that's a significant move for the government to make. To say, well, we can just completely toss the guidelines in the wastebasket once the judge has decided either to go above or below.
That's not what I'm suggesting. I apologize if that's the impression that I left. All I'm trying to say is that to Mr. Zamora's point with respect to the alleged substantive unreasonableness of the sentence, the case law does not require the district court to justify the sentence that he gives the defendant vis-a-vis the guideline range
that
was adopted.
That's true, but that skips over all the procedural problems. I don't think anybody here is arguing, not even Mr. Zamora, that the 240 months was substantively unreasonable in the abstract. I can't imagine making such an argument. But it's the procedural path that gets us there that's important for us to sort out.
And again, what I come back to is that the district court implicitly, by deciding the acceptance of responsibility factual issue in Mr. Zamora's favor, adopted the 168 to 210-month
sentence.
Let's
say we disagree with you. What's the Justice Department's position on what happens to a miscalculated guidelines range, or what import does a miscalculated guidelines range have on appeal if the judge resolves on a non-guideline sentence, either above or below a properly calculated range? If the judge resolves on a non-guideline sentence and it's sufficiently justified on the record by reference to 3553A, is that harmless error in the Justice Department's position?
I'm afraid, Judge, I can't speak for the Justice Department.
Because this is the legal issue that's in tension here with the Supreme Court's cases and what they've said about starting with the range, and also the principle that a non-guideline sentence does not have to be justified with respect to the range. So that leaves open how do we evaluate harmfulness.
And I can't speak for the Justice Department right now on my feet. What I can do if the panel would
this
like...
This is the fourth case today, because we have a sufficiently below-guideline sentence with an alleged miscalculated range. So we've got the mirror images here on this issue, so we really need to know what the Justice Department thinks about this. And maybe you can't answer it on the fly, but somebody's going to have to answer it. We're going to have to answer it at some point.
Right, and what I could do if the panel would like is submit a supplemental brief or a short letter addressing that question.
Certainly, that would be fine. We'll issue an order specifying the amount of time you have to file that, and if counsel for some or all of the defendants would like to weigh in on that point, you are welcome to do so as well.
I'd like to turn now to the Gutierrez.
Certainly, Mr. Gutierrez, for which the problem that I have is actually that I'm baffled, and I don't see the explanation for why Mr. Gutierrez's sentence, why the admissions that he made, especially in light of the judge's, in this instance, quite clear indication that he thinks there's the remorse. He isn't thinking. He never says, "Well, Mr. Gutierrez, you have said the right things, but I think you're just sorry you got caught. You're not sorry that you did it." The judge seems to say, "I get it. You know, you are truly remorseful." Mr. Gutierrez openly says, "We used violence to get what you know we want." He says, shootings happened and would happen. He seems to admit everything, and the timing of his decision not to contest the application of the conspiracy to murder guideline is just the same. So what? Why doesn't the judge give him acceptance of responsibility?
I think that there are two reasons, Judge. One is that Mr. Gutierrez did not provide a particular level of specificity.
Neither did Mr. Zamora.
But then that goes to the second difference between Mr. Zamora and Mr. Gutierrez.
Well, the first isn't a difference. The first is a similarity.
Well, there is a difference in the sense that Mr. Zamora, through his counsel at the sentencing hearing, accepted responsibility not just for all of the conduct that he participated in, but in fact his counsel made a quite sweeping statement that Mr. Zamora accepts responsibility for all of the acts alleged in the indictment, done by either himself or by his co-conspirators. And so he is accepting a broad swath of responsibility, which is different than what Mr. Gutierrez did.
Gutierrez does, too. Looking at the transcript, when he says, we used violence to get what I get what we want. And he says, he admits in pleading guilty to the racketeering conspiracy, this is his lawyer talking, to the racketeering conspiracy, that murder conspiracy was a reasonably foreseeable consequence. Well, he didn't say he was the trigger man. Of course, he wasn't the trigger man with the Pierce murder. He says the same things.
Well, except that in Mr. Gutierrez's sentencing hearing, the government attorney laid out all of these other all of this other conduct and activities that Mr. Gutierrez had participated in. The government counsel went through and discussed Mr. Gutierrez's role in extorting the Maqueros. Government counsel went through and discussed Mr. Gutierrez's role in selling guns. Government counsel discussed Mr. Gutierrez's role in not just the gang's drug distribution conspiracy, but also his own drug distribution that he was doing independent of the gang. And it was only after government counsel outlined each of these activities did then counsel for Mr. Gutierrez say, oh, and by the way, Mr. Gutierrez accepts responsibility for that conduct as well.
But you didn't force Mr. Zamora to do the chapter, book, and verse account of all the problems. Government counsel, you know, can go on for a long time about all of the things that were going on. And I still don't see the difference. He does admit the conspiracy involving murder. The judge says he does accept true responsibility. He's very sorry. He would apologize. He doesn't apologize to the community, but I don't think Mr. Zamora apologized to the community either.
He did, actually. He apologized to the community. He apologized to the city of Chicago.
That just sounds so phony to me, frankly.
And that is where we end up in a situation where this circuit is looking at a cold record, comparing two sentencing hearing transcripts, and applying the standard of review that applies in acceptance of responsibility, the determination of acceptance of responsibility appellate issues.
So should we write an opinion that says the district judge is entitled to be capricious in deciding on identical records who gets acceptance of responsibility and who doesn't? Maybe somebody's English is better. Maybe, you know, they use some magic words.
No, Your Honor. What the circuit should write is an opinion that says that acceptance of responsibility determinations by the district court are owed great deference, which is in keeping with circuit precedent.
But what does deference mean? Does deference mean you can never look at it? I mean, why do we bother with appeals if that's what deference means?
I'm not suggesting that this isn't an issue to look at, but
And then when you're looking at it then, what differences matter? You know, you can always find somebody might say pink and somebody might say dark red, you know, but that probably doesn't matter. What differences matter? I'm finding it very difficult comparing these two to see what significant difference there is.
What mattered to the district court was the allocution made by Mr. Zamora.
Well, do we know that, though? Does the judge tell us in this record that that made a difference?
I believe he notes how strongly Mr. Zamora accepted responsibility for the actions, not only his actions, but for the gang's actions. Mr. Zamora stood up...
Did he say that in Mr. Gutierrez's sentencing hearing?
No, I don't believe he does, but I often
say that. You're just guessing to why he doesn't give Mr. Gutierrez. And, of course, we know from the other argument that you're making that even if he had given Mr. Gutierrez the acceptance of responsibility adjustment, it didn't have to make any difference in the sentence he imposed ultimately anyway.
So long as he provided substantive reasons for that sentence. Yes. But is there a reference to Mr. Zamora sentencing and Mr. Gutierrez's sentencing? No. Are there references to any of the co-defendants? Comparison.
Right, right.
No.
But did the district judge here in Gutierrez's case doesn't say, well, I don't think you're being sincere about that.
He never says that. No.
He just doesn't give acceptance.
He doesn't give acceptance, and what he does is he adopts the government's argument that Mr. Gutierrez is not being specific enough in articulating what exactly he's accepting responsibility for.
And by comparison, in Mr. Zamora's sentencing hearing, Mr. Zamora openly wept in court. Mr. Zamora renounced gang life. He called it a disease upon the community. He had young nieces.
So that's the template that someone needs to get acceptance?
I think it's something that the district court can fairly consider when deciding whether someone deserves acceptance.
Counsel,
should be
Mr.
credited
Gutierrez
with acceptance.
Said that he broke down at one point and there had to be a break.
There was a recess taken in the middle of Mr. Gutierrez's sentencing.
He broke down.
I was not there, Judge. I don't know.
That's what counsel just represented.
I understand that that is what counsel said. As the transcript reads, it does sound like they needed to take a break in order for Mr. Gutierrez to gather his thoughts about what his allocution would be.
Let's say there was an error, and in Mr. Gutierrez's case it was harmful because this was a within-guidelines sentence, and the judge made it clear that he was sentencing at the bottom of the range. So it would have been lower if he had gotten the credit. So the question of harm.
The question of harm goes away then, correct?
No, it doesn't go away.
I'm sorry.
The question of harm is resolved in his favor.
Exactly. No, that is what I meant. We're on the same page there. Yes.
Okay, that's fine. You can continue. Those were the two issues on which I wanted the most input.
And I hope you hadn't finished with Chavez. I've got to say, the quantity of drugs here is so small, easily a user quantity. I'm very troubled about that.
It was a small quantity of drugs. It was a quarter ounce of cocaine, or approximately 7 grams. But under United States v. Franklin Brown, quantity of drugs involved in the exchanges isn't the only factor that the court should consider under a totality of circumstances test. Franklin Brown tells us that we need to look to factors like, as I was explaining earlier in my argument, whether or not the defendant has a so-called stake in the venture. And here we know that both because Mr. Chavez was a member of the Latin Kings and also a leader within the Latin Kings as an Inca, not a low-level gang member, but in fact a manager within the gang, but also because he is heard on a consensual recording with Mr. Shanna saying, in response to a question of, you know, are you okay proceeding with this drug distribution venture, Mr. Chavez says, I'm all for helping you out.
Well, distribution, I don't recall there being a recorded discussion about it being distribution. It would seem to me it was delivery from Shauna to Chavez without any sort of instructions that you have to resell this other than $200 each time we make a delivery.
There was evidence, though, introduced at trial that Mr. Chavez was told about the process. Mr. Shanna testified that he explained to Mr. Chavez how the process would work. He told him that there were 24 people who were involved. You hear on a tape Mr. Dominguez explaining to Mr. Chavez that he needs to return with $200, but that he can sell it for more. He could make more money off of that cocaine.
Could I quickly ask you, was there testimony or evidence at the trial about what the market value of 7 grams would be? I mean, so that we can see what $200 is. If the market value was $2,000 and all he has to do is give $200 back, that would certainly make it much more likely that he was distributing. If the market value was somewhat close to $200, that would make it seem much more likely that it was personal use and he could just keep it and pay the $200 for it. So do we have testimony or evidence about that?
I don't believe there was evidence on that point in the record, Judge.
Seems like a serious gap in your theory.
Well, I think what you have here, though, are other factors that are stressed in Franklin v. Brown. You have the fact that the cocaine was being sold on credit. Mr. Chavez never paid for the cocaine when he received it. He would return with the $200 at some later date. You have the fact that there are frequent...
That's what buyers do also. They get credit purchases.
Right, which is why it's a totality of circumstances test.
Yeah,
under.
I buy everything at Macy's. So. Every time.
But that goes to why you look at the totality of the circumstances. So the fact that the cocaine is being sold on credit is one factor. The frequency of the exchanges, the fact that Mr. Chavez met with Mr. Dominguez and with Mr. Shanna 6 times in 4 weeks is another factor we look at.
You look at the standardized nature of the transactions. He met with the same two people. He received the same amount of cocaine. He returned with the same amount of money. That's another factor that we look at under Franklin Brown. And then Franklin Brown also tells us that you look to the mutual level of trust between the parties. And that goes back to the fact that these are fellow gang members, but it also goes to the fact that Mr. Chavez is having conversations with Mr. Shanna and Dominguez about guns, about police presence in the neighborhood. He's caught on a recording saying, be careful, there are police in the neighborhood, just before he accepts cocaine from these two gang members. He discusses mandatory bust outs. He talks about the show of force that he is having his peewees or his soldiers make. He says that he's trying to do something, which Mr. Shanna testifies at trial, shows that he understood to be Mr. Chavez saying that he was trying to make a name for himself in the gang. And he talks about Jorge Camargo's shooting. This is the member of the Mexican band who was shot by Mr. Chavez's soldiers, by Mr. Chavez's own admission, within Mr. Chavez's section during a mandatory bust-out period. This is all caught on tape during these drug-related exchanges between Mr. Chavez and Mr. Shanna and Mr. Dominguez.
But why does all that evidence help us decide whether this 7 grams is something that Mr. Chavez just wants to use for himself because he happens to be a drug addict, versus something that he's going to use to further the gang's activities, sell, keep some money for his area, and give the 200 back?
Because
it
goes to
how it distinguishes.
Well, it goes to this level of trust that he has with his fellow gang members. The kinds of conversations that Mr. Chavez is having with his fellow gang members.
He's willing to sell him 7 grams of cocaine and get their $200 later. So I say, without knowing how that $200 fits into the bigger picture, it's very difficult to say what's happening to that 7 grams.
And again, that is why in Franklin Brown, the circuit was careful not to say that there are any factors that are dispositive of the difference between a conspiracy, a drug distribution conspiracy, and a buyer-seller relationship. And instead, he looked to the totality of the circumstances. So the fact that he's being sold cocaine on credit, I submit, is not dispositive, doesn't completely answer the question for us, but it is a factor that this court can fairly look to at the same time that it considers all of these other factors at play. And the kinds of conversations that Mr. Chavez was having with his fellow gang members are facts and evidence the jury could use to fairly infer that Mr. Chavez was a knowing member of that drug distribution conspiracy. Because the kinds of conversations he was having with them are not conversations that two people who are in some sort of like arm's length business transaction would have. They're the kinds of conversations that co-conspirators would have.
I understand that he was a fairly recent Inca, maybe a month or so.
That is what the record suggests.
So what is there anything in the record about his role in the Kings prior to becoming an Inca?
Not specific to Mr. Chavez, but there is evidence in the record about the general gang hierarchy,
right,
and the fact that one is not simply...
But there's nothing specific about what his membership role was prior to being...
That is correct, Judge.
Right, thank you.
I'd like to discuss the Pinkerton instruction issue that came up during appellant's argument. And as you pointed out, Chief Judge Wood, the government has conceded error in this case. There really is no choice in that respect, given the circuit's controlling precedent in the United States v. Elizondo.
You argue that it's reviewed by plain error. Is that right?
Well, we make two arguments as to what the correct standard of review is. We make an argument, the government argues, that it could be argued, and one of the positions we take in our brief, that the defendants affirmatively waived any appellate issue with respect to the omission of the second half of the Pinkerton instruction, because their objection to the Pinkerton instruction at the jury instruction conference was very general. I believe it was a one-sentence objection by counsel for Mr. Zambrano about we object to the Pinkerton instruction generally. No one pointed out that the instruction, as proposed by the government, missed that second half of the instruction.
That sounds more like an omission and forfeiture than it sounds like waiver. They're saying something about the instruction, they just don't finish the thought.
there is case law that says that if you're not specific about the nature of your objection and then you follow it up at the end of the jury instruction conference with affirmative statements like, I have no further objection, which are statements that were made here by several of the defendants, that there is a waiver argument or that the defendants have waived this particular issue for appeal. But even if the court doesn't find that the defendants waived this particular appellate issue, it is reviewed under plain error. And the error here, while the government concedes that it was error to leave out that second half of the instruction, the fact remains that under Elizondo, the court found that this was not, that this same exact error was not a reason to reverse any of the convictions.
Elizondo got the standard wrong for the error, the harmless error.
It talks about harmless error.
Yeah, it decided that issue on the basis of sufficiency of the evidence, which is the wrong standard under Nader and Chapman.
Well,
so I don't think we should be applying the Elizondo harmless error analysis. We need to go with what the Supreme Court says the standard means.
But the analysis, setting aside the review question, the analysis or the logic of Elizondo is still informative here, because what Elizondo did is say, well, in terms of the defendant's substantive offenses, it doesn't actually matter that the Pinkerton instruction was erroneous or defective, because there were alternative theories of liability by which each of the defendants could be held liable either as principals or as aiders and abettors of their particular substantive offenses. And that's what we have here, and none of the defendants have disputed that there was evidence that's sufficient to substantiate their substantive convictions separate and apart from the Pinkerton instruction.
Does that evidence cover the question whether those substantive activities were done in furtherance of the conspiracy? I mean, they did things, right? Many of the defendants did particular things, whether it was Zambrano and Vicente Garcia with the hand smashing or what have you. But what about in furtherance of the conspiracy? Those separate findings might not cover that base.
Well, are you asking whether there are findings in furtherance of a conspiracy for purposes of later sentencing decisions?
The Pinkerton. I mean, you know, in other words, Pinkerton itself requires that the other person be doing something within the scope of the conspiracy.
I believe there was evidence, strong evidence, to show that the defendants were extorting the Maqueros, were smashing the hands of fellow gang members, were discharging firearms in the course of retaliatory shooting against rival gang members, and this was all part of the racketeering enterprise that's known as the Latin Kings. But what I'm also saying is that you can set aside Pinkerton. There was evidence separate. There was sufficient evidence to convict the defendants of their substantive offenses, even setting aside the Pinkerton theory of liability. And so because
sufficient, you're saying there's sufficient evidence to show that each of the defendants committed predicate acts for purposes of the RICO conspiracy without relying on Pinkerton. Is that what you're arguing?
That's correct, but what I want to clarify is that here the substantive offenses aren't actually predicate acts of the RICO conspiracy charge. They were separately, in addition to being charged under Section 1962D, the defendants were separately charged under Section 1951 for extortion, under Section 1959 for violence committed in aid of racketeering, under Section 924C. And so to convict them under those particular substantive offenses, the jury didn't actually have to find that those offenses were committed in furtherance of the conspiracy.
Right. There were two alternate bases for conviction on the substantive offenses, as I understand it, the Pinkerton basis and the direct route that they were...
Right, that they were either the principal offenders or that they aided and abetted that particular offense. And because you have these two routes, the fact that the Pinkerton route is muddied by the defective instruction doesn't create error here. And in fact, as noted during appellant's argument, given the language of the instruction and the context in which the defective Pinkerton instruction was given, there's also no error. And what I mean by that is that the jury was clearly instructed that they needed to find that someone was a co-conspirator before they could consider them liable for a co-conspirator's other offenses. And the Pinkerton, the defective Pinkerton instruction was given only three sentences after the district court clearly instructed the jury that in order to find a defendant a member of the RICO conspiracy, they needed to find that the defendant was aware of the common purpose or purposes, was a willing participant of in the conspiracy, and that they needed to make those findings beyond a reasonable doubt.
You might want to spend a minute discussing Mr. Zambrano's Confrontation Clause argument. As I understand it, he's saying that although the confession, Mr. Guzman's confession, was properly sanitized for Bruton purposes, when the court turned around and said, but you can use Mr. Guzman's activities under the Pinkerton theory, that that actually reintroduced a Confrontation Clause problem into the trial.
And
Mr. Zambrano, had it been a completely separate trial, wouldn't you couldn't have gotten Mr. Guzman's confession in there.
And Mr. Zambrano's alleged error is not actually error in this case because, again, you go back to the language of the Pinkerton instruction that was given, and in order to find Mr. Zambrano liable for Mr. Guzman's offenses, the jury first had to find that Mr. Zambrano himself was a conspirator or a member of the conspiracy, and then they couldn't have found Mr. Zambrano liable of Mr. Guzman's offenses because they didn't have, other than the RICO conspiracy charge, Mr. Zambrano and Mr. Guzman did not have overlapping, their other offenses weren't overlapping. Mr. Zambrano was charged, in addition with the RICO conspiracy count, with extortion and with committing violence in aid of the racketeering, whereas Mr. Zambrano's only other conviction besides the RICO conspiracy was a conviction under Section 846.
You mean Guzman?
Mr. Guzman,
yes. Yeah, right. You know, they're more for... Because, I mean, the structural problem is troublesome in that if you will agree that at a separate trial, Guzman's confession would have been hearsay, there would have been an issue about whether it could come in to a hypothetical separate trial for Zambrano. And Zambrano probably has an incentive to cross-examine anybody whose activity might be attributable to him, to explore whether that really happened and whether it was within the scope of the conspiracy. It does seem to come in by the back door. Now, you're suggesting that Guzman is somehow so separate from Zambrano that it's not actually a practical issue here, but it certainly could be.
I mean, it could be, but again, that's not the issue here. It's also worth noting that the testimony about Mr. Guzman's statement, because the statement itself was never actually admitted into trial, it was just testimony.
Who testified, right?
Right, and the testimony was carefully tailored to make sure that it didn't reference Mr. Zambrano by name, didn't reference him by title.
No, that part is all fine. It's when it comes back in again at the last minute under Pinkerton that Mr. Zambrano is complaining.
Correct, but again, I go back to the limiting instruction, the clear limiting instruction that the district court gave to the jury, telling them that Mr. Guzman's statement is, in fact, should only be used as evidence against Mr. Guzman. And then
then all the evidence under Mr. Guzman is now usable against Mr. Zambrano because of the RICO conspiracy. So does that instruction actually do what you are saying it does?
Well, it wouldn't have in this case because of the different substantive offenses that Mr. Zambrano and Mr. Guzman were facing.
Okay.
I would like to speak to Mr. Ramirez's argument regarding the district court's finding at sentencing that he was liable for Oberia Pierce's murder. And in particular, there's a contention made that Mr. Pierce's murder was simply a random act of violence and not in furtherance of the conspiracy. In fact, there is evidence in the record to suggest that this was strongly a part of the Latin King conspiracy, in part because these were soldiers of Mr. Ramirez's who committed the shooting by Mr. Ramirez's own admission. These were soldiers who were armed, via the gang. These were soldiers who reported to Mr. Ramirez, whose responsibility it was to make sure that his soldiers were actually out on the street enforcing the gang rules. There was also a suggestion by Mr. Ramirez during his opening argument or during the opening argument that there was no mistaken, there was no gang affiliation or no evidence of a gang affiliation or a mistaken identity or any kind of altercation between Mr. Pierce and his friend Keith Morgan, who was with him that evening, and the soldiers from Mr. Ramirez's section. In fact, at trial, Mr. Shanna did testify that based on his conversation with Mr. Ramirez 3 days after Mr. Pierce's murder, he did believe that he understood Mr. Ramirez to be telling him that Mr. Ramirez's soldiers understood that, or he understood that Mr. Ramirez's soldiers felt that Mr. Pierce and Mr. Morgan were rival members of the gang. Mr. Ramirez's own words suggested that there was some kind of altercation that arose between Mr. Ramirez's soldiers and Mr. Pierce and Mr. Morgan. And given that evidence, as well as the broader evidence presented at trial regarding the Latin Kings' overall purpose, which was to protect their hood not just from rival gangs, but to protect their hood from sort of any foreign element, anyone who seemed to be there in opposition to them, to be creating problems, it was Mr. Pierce's murder was in fact in furtherance of the Latin Kings' conspiracy, and the district court did not err in finding Mr. Ramirez liable for Mr. Pierce's murder and then sentencing him accordingly. If there are no further questions at this time from the panel, I would simply ask that the panel affirm the defendant's convictions and sentences. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. So we have a number of people who have reserved rebuttal time. I will let you come up in the order you choose.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please this Court once again. I'd like to quickly turn this Court's attention to the government's violation of Mr. Zambrano's Fifth Amendment rights at trial. In count 10 of the indictment, the government alleged that Mr. Zambrano and his co-defendants conspired to commit extortion in violation of the Hobbs Act. Specifically, the government alleged that Mr. Zambrano and his co-defendants conspired to take money from a group of people known as the Maqueros, that they did so through the use of force or threatened force, violence, or fear, and that this conduct occurred between the years 2000 and 2008. But at trial, the only evidence of the use of force or threatened force that the government submitted was the testimony of one witness who testified about an incident that occurred in January 1998, roughly 2 years prior to the conduct, to the time period of the conduct alleged in the indictment. In United States versus Ross, this court endorsed the Ninth Circuit's opinion in United States versus Hinton that a 7-month differential between the facts proven at trial and those alleged in the indictment is prejudicial and unconstitutional.
So why couldn't the jury have inferred, though, from the regularity of the payments, which Mr. Shanna testifies go all the way through 2008, that there was economic coercion on the part of the Latin King gang against the Maqueros? You know, you don't pay $2,000, $2,500 a week or a month or whatever it was, to somebody just for fun. I mean, they're engaged in an illegal operation. They're paying protection money to the Latin Kings. A permissible inference, it seems.
Yes, Your Honor, and the government makes this argument in their brief. But the cases that this circuit has decided and that the government cites in its brief, United States versus Sturman, United States versus Granados, we have clear situations where the defendant is making continuous statements, continuous threats to the victim, saying continuous threats of economic harm. And we have testimony from the victims saying, well, the defendant called me and said that either you do this or I'm going to ruin your business. We don't have that in this case. In this case, all we have is the testimony of one witness who testified about an event that happened 2 years prior to the time period alleged in the indictment. And, Your Honors, I would just like to say that this case presents a bigger question of clarity and certainty. That is, Mr. Zambrano's case presents this court with a crossroads. Either it can go down the path of saying, well, we're not concerned with precision in the charging document. We're not concerned with necessarily with the processes that a sentencing court, that a district court arrives at a defendant's sentence. Or this court can take the other path. It can say, no, we are concerned with some measure of specificity and precision in the charging document. This court can say that the sentencing court's processes are important. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Your Honor, just I'd like to clarify about this is the Pinkerton, about if the defendants objected. And it was more than just a general objection. Though there weren't many words, at the jury instruction conference, the defense did object. But there it was, you have to look at it in the context. The only instruction offered was one by the government that did not have beyond reasonable doubt language. So what else, if you look at it logically, what else would they be arguing? They're not, the defenses were not saying you cannot put a Pinkerton instruction in light of that there were drug conspiracy, RICO conspiracy. They know that a Pinkerton instruction would be probably in the case. But
the flaw was not identified.
Excuse me?
The specific flaw was not identified.
Defendant did say it was the Pinkerton.
Right, but the flaw in the instruction wasn't flagged for the judge or for the prosecution to fix it.
Well,
so why doesn't that put us into plain error?
It was a faulty instruction given by the government. The government did not say to the judge this was a modified instruction of the pattern, the regular pattern of criminal jury instruction. So he did not. The district court may not have known, but he knew there was a problem with the instruction. Okay, now there could have been more. The judge could have said, "Well, what is this?" He could have asked more questions, and the defense could have.
The defense could have specifically said, "This is the problem with the instruction." That's what you would expect at an instructions conference, not just a blanket objection, but an identification of the problem. That's the whole point of the instructions conference.
By the very fact that they did make the objection. You knew all it's really required is that at jury instruction, you know there's a problem. There was a problem.
That's not the law.
There was a problem with the instruction.
That's just not the law. You may not have waived it. But
I think in the context of what was offered, it was objected to. And it was understood. It was the language, not just a general, we don't want the Pinkerton instruction. And the second issue is about the evidence with because there was a lot of evidence that the defendants would have been found guilty anyway. The only thing I'll say about that is it's a requirement of the government to find this beyond a reasonable doubt. They must get a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury has to find it, but they must provide it. So it was a lack of providing that, and then I think it was a flaw, and that was a flaw that it was inapplicable, invalid. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning again. I'd just like to briefly address the government's suggestion that there was trial testimony that Mr. Pierce's murder was committed because Mr. Pierce was perceived to be a rival gang member. This argument was not raised at Mr. Ramirez's sentencing. It was not in the government's sentencing memorandum where they discussed why Mr. Ramirez should be held accountable for this murder. It was not talked about at sentencing. It was not addressed in the government's appellee brief in this case. In fact, the only reference to Mr. Shanna's testimony regarding the murder is on page 31 of their brief, and he says, Shanna testified that he understood Ramirez to be telling him that one of his soldiers had murdered Pierce. There's nothing to say that whoever murdered Mr. Pierce perceived him to be a rival gang member.
just because the Latin Kings were a violent organization and just because the gang did use violence to further their goals does not mean every violent act committed within the geographical so-called territory of the Latin Kings was committed to further the conspiracy's goals. And that is the ultimate error in Mr. Ramirez's case. And for that reason, I would ask that you vacate his sentence and remand for resentencing. And unless there are further questions from the panel, I'll rest on my briefs. Thank you.
I think some of you had your time run out, but I'll let you have a minute to rebut.
On behalf of Mr. Gutierrez, I would just respond to two matters that the government brought up. When the government mentioned Mr. Zamora's emotional overwhelmment, I would simply refer to page 25 of Mr. Gutierrez's sentencing transcript, where it does indicate he, too, was emotionally overwhelmed. And I would also indicate that certainly there was a harm in this case because he was sentenced at the low end. He was a criminal history category 1 with 0 criminal history points, so that would make a difference in his sentence here. He was not an educated, articulate man, but he was contrite, he was remorseful, and he complied with both the requirements and the spirit of acceptance and responsibility. Thank you.
Thank you. Nothing? Okay. One more.
Just very briefly, Your Honors, on behalf of Mr. Chavez, I just would like to suggest that in finding supporting this conviction for distribution of the cocaine based on the 7-gram exchange, a credit payment, would grossly expand this court's view of drug conspiracy law. I mean, Carey explicitly held that unless the buyer further distributes the drugs, there can be no drug distribution conspiracy. There are fairly few cases that suggest that even without a distribution, if the person assists the distributor in his distribution, that's not present here either. So I would respectfully ask this court to look closely at Mr. Chavez's conviction, though a high standard, and assist him in his reversal. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further from either side? The court appreciates the efforts on the part of all counsel today. This is a large, complex case. We will take it under advisement, and we will issue an order about the post-argument briefs.